Chapter 17. Yahweh Visible and Invisible. At the close of the last chapter, I noted that the word of Yahweh, being a visible appearance of God as a man, raised certain questions. One of those was how a first century Jew would have parsed the idea of Jesus being the Word made flesh. True, there was Old Testament precedent for Yahweh being visible and embodied. That phenomenon would have helped a Jew accept at least the idea that God could show up in human form. But it was more complicated than that. When Jesus referred to God in the third person, or prayed to God, what then? Would a Jew have been able to wrap her mind around that one? How could God be here, visible and visibly and physically, and still be in heaven? Today, this apparent conundrum is what keeps many Jews from embracing Christianity. It feels like polytheism to them. Given this context, it's amazing how first century Jews could embrace Jesus as Yahweh and not feel as if they were betraying the God of Israel. In fact, these same Jews were willing to die instead of worshiping the gods of the Greek and Romans. We could also ask certain questions about readers of the Old Testament prior to the times of Jesus. When ancient Israelites read the passages we looked at in this last chapter, did they imagine that Yahweh was localized in only one place? He had left heaven? He was no longer omnipresent? The startling reality is that long before Jesus and the New Testament, careful readers of the Old Testament would not have been troubled by the notion of essentially two Yahwehs, one invisible and in heaven, and the other manifest on earth in a variety of visible forms, including that of a man. In some instances, the two Yahweh figures are found together in the same scene. In this and the chapters that follow, we'll see that the Word was just one expression of a visible Yahweh in human form. The concept of a Godhead in the Old Testament has many facets and layers. After the birth of his promised son Isaac, Abraham's spiritual journey included a divine figure that is integral to Israelite Godhead thinking, the angel of Yahweh. Although the most telling passages that show this angel as a visible embodiment of the very presence of Yahweh occur later than the time of Abraham, there are early hints of his nature during the lifetimes of Abraham and his sons. The angel of Yahweh. The heart-wrenching story of Genesis 22, where Abraham was prepared to sacrifice his covenant son Isaac, is our next stop. It's something of a transitional passage. We've seen that Abraham has had several encounters with Yahweh. The expression used to convey the visible, physical nature of those encounters has, to this point, been the word of Yahweh. Genesis 22 marks a shift in the language for a visible Yahweh figure to the angel of Yahweh. Although the angel of Yahweh appears earlier than Genesis 22, Genesis 16, 7 through 11, 21, 17, this particular appearance begins to blur the identities of Yahweh and his angel. Genesis 22, 1 through 9, relates how Abraham has taken Isaac at the bizarre command of Yahweh to Mount Moriah to offer his son as a burnt offering. We pick up the story in verse 10. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. And the angel of Yahweh called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Do not stretch out your hand against the boy. Do not do anything to him. For now I know that you are the one who fears God, since you have not withheld your son, your only child, from me." And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a ram was caught in the thicket by its horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it as a burnt offering in place of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place, "Yahweh Will Provide," for which reason it is said today, "On the mountain of Yahweh it shall be provided." And the angel of Yahweh called to Abraham a second time from heaven. And he said, I swear by myself, declares Yahweh, that because you have done this thing, you have not withheld your son, your only child, that I will certainly bless you and greatly multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and as the sands that is by the shore of the sea, and your offspring will take possession of the gate of his enemies. All the nations of the earth will be blessed through your offspring, because you have listened to my voice. Genesis 22:10-18. The first thing to notice is that when the angel of Yahweh speaks to Abraham, Abraham recognizes the voice. He does not ask the identity of the speaker as though the voice is unfamiliar. He does not fear that he is hearkening to the voice of another god. The reader, however, knows that the source is not Yahweh, per se, but the angel of Yahweh. The word translated angel here is the Hebrew word malak, which simply means messenger. The next observation is very important. The angel speaks to Abraham in verse 11, and so is distinguished from God. But immediately after doing so, he commends Abraham for not withholding Isaac from me. There is a switch to the first person, which, given that God himself had told Abram to sacrifice Isaac, Genesis 22:1-2, seems to require seeing Yahweh as the speaker. Many scholars would say that this is due to the angel being Yahweh's mouthpiece, standing in Yahweh's place, as it were. But that idea is conveyed only later in the passage when, in verse 16, the angel prefaces his words with declares Yahweh. In verse 11, there is no such clarification. The wording of the text blurs the distinction between Yahweh and the angel by swapping the angel into the role of the person who initially demanded the sacrifice as a test, Yahweh himself, Genesis 22:1-2. Consequently, the biblical writer had the opportunity to make sure Yahweh and the angel were distinguished, but did not do so. This failure occurs in several other places in the Old Testament, even more overtly. It's not really a failure, it's not a careless oversight. The wording is designed to blur the two persons. The gods of Isaac and Jacob. Genesis 26:1-5 marks Yahweh's first visible appearance to Isaac. And Isaac went to Gerar, and Yahweh appeared to him. It is a sign to Isaac that the covenant made with his father will be carried on through him. Yahweh repeats the words of the covenant to Isaac, verses 3-4. I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father, and I will multiply your descendants like the stars of heaven, and I will give to your descendants all these lands, and all nations of the earth will be blessed through your offspring. Later in Genesis 26:23-25, Yahweh appears to Isaac again. The baton has been passed. Isaac's son Jacob receives the same divine approval in a series of visual encounters with Yahweh. The first instance is the well-known story of Jacob's ladder in Genesis 28:10-22. Several details of the vision are noteworthy for continuing our discussion. Jacob is on the way to Haran, verses 1-2, the place from which his ancestor Abraham had departed years earlier at Yahweh's command. Jacob is on the way to Haran, verses 1-2, the place from which his ancestor Abraham had departed years earlier at Yahweh's command. Jacob is fleeing the wrath of his brother Esau after stealing the birthright through deception. Genesis 27. Scholars generally agree that the ladder is probably some sort of stair-step structure in Jacob's dream. Connected heaven and earth, perhaps a ziggurat. Jacob sees angels of God going up and down the structure, an indication of the presence of the divine council. Jacob also sees the visible Yahweh standing beside him, the familiar language for Yahweh in human form we noted with Abraham. In verse 15, Yahweh promises protection for Jacob and pledges to bring the man back to this location, the land promised to Abraham. Jacob names the place Bethel, house of God, verse 19. and erects a pillar to commemorate his conversation with Yahweh. Verses 18 and 19. Jacob saw the visible Yahweh at Bethel. Given what we've already seen in Genesis, this isn't unusual. Things get more interesting in Genesis 31, the story of how Jacob becomes wealthy at the expense of his uncle Laban. Jacob's flocks had multiplied supernaturally despite Laban's attempts to cheat him. As their relationship soured, Jacob had a dream. The wording is significant. Then the angel of God said to me in the dream, "Jacob," and I said, "Here I am." And he said, "Lift up your eyes and see, all the rams mounting the flock are streaked, speckled and dappled, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a stone pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now get up and go out from this land and return to the land of your birth." Genesis 31, verses 11 through 13. The angel of God explicitly tells Jacob in verse 13 that he was the God of Bethel. Jacob had seen angels at Bethel and one lone deity, Yahweh, the God of Abraham. It was Yahweh who had promised protection and to whom Jacob had erected the stone pillar. This passage fuses the two figures. This fusion is helpful for parsing Jacob's subsequent divine encounters. As Jacob's life proceeds, he's in and out of trouble, yet Yahweh is with him. After he succeeds in fleeing from his uncle Laban, Jacob learns in the course of his travels that he will soon be coming face to face with Esau, the brother from whom he had stolen his father's blessing years ago. At the time of Jacob's trickery, Esau had sought to kill him. And so now, Jacob wondering whether his brother is still holding a grudge. That meeting occurs in Genesis 33. But it's what's happening to Jacob in the preceding chapter that draws our attention. In Genesis 32, we learn a lot about Jacob's state of mind and God's loyalty to him. In Genesis 32:1, God sends an angel to meet him. This time it's no dream. Nevertheless, Jacob can't set aside his anxiety. He takes steps to bribe Esau, sending extravagant gifts ahead of the caravan. He removes his children and their four mothers to the other side of Jabbok, a small stream. Genesis 32:22 and 23. Alone that night, he has his most famous encounter with God, or maybe someone else who was also God. The story reads, "And Jacob remained alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of dawn. And when he saw that he could not prevail against him, he struck his hip socket so that Jacob's hip socket was sprained as he wrestled with him. Then he said, 'Let me go, for dawn is breaking.' But he answered, 'I will not let you go unless you bless me.' Then he said to him, 'What is your name?' And he said, 'Jacob.' And he said, 'Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed.' Then Jacob asked and said, 'Please tell me your name.' And he said, 'Why do you ask this? For my name.' And he blessed him there. Then Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, which means, 'I have seen God face to face, and my life was spared.'" Genesis 32:24-30. Genesis 32:28-29 makes it apparent that the man with whom Jacob wrestled was a divine being. The mysterious combatant himself says, "You have striven with Elohim," a term we know can be translated either God or a God. The narrative nowhere says Jacob's encounter was only a vision. This Elohim is tangible and corporeal. Hosea 12:3-4 confirms the divine identity of Jacob's opponent, but then adds two surprising details. Note the way Hosea uses parallelism to express the thought. In the womb, he, Jacob, deceived his brother. And in his manhood, he struggled, Hebrew Sarah, with God, Elohim. He struggled, Hebrew Yasar, with the angel and prevailed. He pleaded for his mercy. He met him at Bethel, and there he spoke with him. Not only does Hosea describe Jacob's Elohim opponent as an angel, but the last line of his quotation identifies this angel with Bethel. Curiously, we know from Genesis 32 that this incident did not occur at Bethel. It was at the waters of Jabbok. Hosea's inspired commentary on the incident isn't about geography, though. He's telling us that Jacob wrestled with God himself, physically embodied, and identifies God with the angel who said he was the God of Bethel. We've seen this confusion of God with an angel before. It is deliberate. The point is not that Yahweh, the God of Israel, is a mere angel. The reverse is the case. The angel is Yahweh. We have one more passage to consider. The way it fuses Yahweh and the angel is nothing short of amazing. Genesis 48 records Jacob's deathbed words of blessing to Joseph's children. The passage references the God who had appeared to him at Bethel, who, readers know from Genesis 31:13, is called an angel. It's all set up for the thunderbolt in the section in bold below, verses 15-16. And it happened that after these things, it was said to Joseph, "Behold, your father is ill." And he took his two sons with him, Ephraim and Manasseh. And it was told to Jacob, "Behold, your son Joseph has come to you." Then Israel strengthened himself, and he sat up in the bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, "El Shaddai appeared to me in Luz," that's Bethel, "in the land of Canaan, and blessed me, and said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and make you numerous, and will make you a company of nations, and I will give this land to your offspring after you as an everlasting possession.' And Israel stretched out his right hand and put it on the head of Ephraim." Now he was the younger. "And his left hand on the head of Manasseh, crossing his hands, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, 'The God, Elohim, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God, Elohim, who shepherded me all my life unto this day, the angel, Malak, who redeemed me from all evil, may he bless the boys.'" Genesis 48, 1 through 4, 14 through 16. The parallel position of Elohim and Malak, angel, is unmistakable. Since the Bible very clearly teaches that God is eternal and existed before all things, and that angels are created beings, the point of this explicit parallel is not to say that God is an angel. On the other hand, it affirms that this angel is God. But the most striking feature is the verb, "may he bless." In Hebrew, the verb "bless" in this passage is not grammatically plural, which would indicate two different persons are being asked to bless the boys. Rather, it is singular, thereby telegraphing a tight fusion of the two divine beings on this part of the author. In other words, the writer had a clear opportunity to distinguish the God of Israel from the angel, but instead merges their identities. As we leave this chapter, the implications of what we've seen are staggering. The patriarchal stories create an astonishing picture for us. If there is only one God, one Yahweh, then why does the writer fuse Yahweh and the angel in some passages, but have the angel refer to God in the third person in others? Why blur the distinction between Yahweh and his angels and keep them distinct? What's being communicated? When the biblical text does this, it pushes us to wonder whether there are two Yahwehs, one invisible in heaven and one visible on earth. We'll see next that this is precisely the point. The God of Israel is God, but in more than one person.